Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport. Offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at FRLA.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Still more legislative gunplay in Tallahassee today, including a measure that was nearly changed to include a repeal of Florida's Stand Your Ground law.
We're not here to strengthen Stand Your Ground. We're here to address the concerns of the community, and if we don't address those concerns, then we should repeal it and start all over.
Also tonight, is there anything the Florida legislature can do to help the kids and others who are under the jurisdiction of a troubled Department of Children and Families?
It's just hard to imagine some of the decisions that get made by people in the face of the reality that the young people are facing in their homes or in their living conditions, whatever they are.
We'll also look at bills to control invasive lionfish, give state workers more health insurance options, and extend in-state college tuition rates to children of undocumented immigrants. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Here's a story that was breaking as this edition of Capitol Report was being prepared for air. A move to expand the state's private school scholarship or voucher program may be dead in the legislature for this year. Late this afternoon, State Senator Bill Galvano, Republican from Bradenton, withdrew his voucher expansion bill. Support for the bill had come from such places as former Governor Jeb Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education. Opposition to the bill had come from groups like the League of Women Voters and the Teachers Union. Those organizations expressed joy and relief following the bill withdrawal. Not so happy was House Speaker Will Weatherford. He sent out a statement saying he saw no reason for the bill to be withdrawn and worried thousands of children would be denied more opportunities for a better life because of it. While the so-called warning shot bill was being teed up for a vote in the Senate, a couple of gun-related measures made it through the full House today. But as Sasha Cordner reports, verbal shots were exchanged between lawmakers before a revived attempt to repeal Florida's Stand Your Ground law once again went down to defeat.
It's been a busy week for National Rifle Association's Marion Hammer. She's been lobbying the legislature on legislation from the bipartisan tweak of Stand Your Ground to allowing gun owners to carry their firearms without a permit during a state of emergency or mandatory evacuation. And it's just the third week of session and already a bill enhancing the penalties against insurance companies who discriminate against gun owners has passed the full Senate. And Hammer says there's more to follow in both chambers.
Part of the bills deal with making corrections that the governor's task force recommended with regard to 1020 life. There's another bill moving that will protect children from school administrators who seem to lack common sense. Legislation is about protecting the people from people who are actually supposed to be looking out for us.
One of the first gun bills the House easily voted on Thursday is a measure aimed at revising school's zero-tolerance policies concerning guns and kids. Currently, a student could face a suspension or a juvenile record for wearing clothes with a firearm or simulating a firearm with their finger. It's House sponsor's Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley. The measure passed the House 98-17 with no debate, but it was a vote on the so-called warning shot bill that grew contentious. Conform now to the Senate bill, the House measure seeks to clarify the existing self-defense law by allowing for the display of a weapon or firing of a warning shot in a situation where someone feels they're in danger. A person whose case was found not guilty or had their case dismissed would also be eligible to have their record expunged. The bill by Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby is also aimed at getting rid of the the unintended consequences of Florida's 10 to 20 life law. So it allows defendants to avoid a minimum mandatory sentence in aggravated assault cases if they had what's called a good faith belief that they were justified in threatening to use force, wasn't committing a crime, and didn't pose a threat to the public safety of others. It's inspired by Marissa Alexander, a Jacksonville woman who fired a warning shot during an alleged domestic violence dispute with her husband. She had claimed self-defense, but a judge said it didn't apply, and she was charged with aggravated assault and received a 20-year prison sentence. That latter part of the bill was an amendment offered by Fort Walton Beach Republican Representative Matt Gaetz, which was adopted Wednesday. And the next day, when the measure came up for an actual vote, House Democratic Leader Perry Thurston tried to tack on an amendment of his own to repeal Stand Your Ground. He says it's sending the wrong message at the wrong time.
We're indicating that firing a warning shot is okay in an atmosphere where we just saw individuals killed for walking through a neighborhood. We saw individuals shot and killed for riding in a car with music too loud. We've seen individuals shot in a movie theater for texting.
More than a quarter of the House members signed on as co-sponsors of the bill, which includes several Democrats. One Democrat is even a main sponsor of the bill, and Tallahassee Democratic Representative Alan Williams, whose attempt to repeal Stand Your Ground failed last year, is a co-sponsor as well. At the time, Thurston had backed the bipartisan tweak of Stand Your Ground over the repeal, so when Thurston introduced his amendment to repeal the controversial law, several Republicans were upset. That includes Representative Gaetz, who had taken up the repealer bill in the committee he chairs last year. The bill was defeated with most Democrats voting alongside Republicans.
I look for every opportunity to be bipartisan, and I don't know that there's a more bipartisan outcome than when every Republican and a majority of Democrats say that Floridians who are under attack shouldn't have a duty to turn their back and run.
But Thurston says if Gaetz had been amenable to hearing the bipartisan tweak, he wouldn't have had to pursue this amendment. However, since that hasn't happened, Thurston says he hopes they could do something on the floor.
We think that the state of Florida deserves better. We think that we should be looking at how we can make this law better. If that means start over and do it better and craft it the right way, then we should repeal it and start all over.
Still, the amendment failed 33-83, and when the so-called warning shot bill came up for an actual vote, it passed with some Democrats opposed, including Thurston. Meanwhile, after some discussion on the so-called warning shot bill Thursday, the Florida Senate is now poised to vote on the bill as early as next week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Hundreds of children die of abuse or neglect in Florida each year. Others suffer routine beatings or turn to the sex trade to survive on the streets. The state's Department of Children and Families is charged with saving these kids, but even those within the agency admit it's failing. Amy Kiley with member station WMFE in Orlando takes a look at some reform proposals and whether they might actually help.
About 50,000 children and some young adults are engaged with Florida's Department of Children and Families each year. Kathy, who declines to give her last name, is one of them. After months in a domestic violence shelter, her mother returned the family to her abusive boyfriend. DCF got involved when Kathy's Girl Scout leader, Mariana Ordaz, reported what she saw in the family home.
The mom's boyfriend would abuse the mother and then blame problems on Kathy. So as a result, the mother would then hit Kathy to make him happy.
Kathy says DCF didn't help.
And I told them the situation. I told them why I didn't want to go back home. And they just refused to take anything into action.
Kathy ran away her junior year, and Ordaz says the authorities sent her back. The next time Kathy escaped, she drifted between the homes of friends who would keep her secret. She was missing and homeless for over 2 months while under the care of DCF. Eventually, DCF let Kathy stay with Ordaz without official guardianship. Kathy's younger siblings are still with their mother, despite reports to DCF and photos of her little sister's cuts and bruises. A Florida State University professor who testified before a House committee last month says 432 children died of abuse or neglect in Florida in 2012. She says about 40% had contact with DCF. Casey Family Programs is the nation's largest foundation for child welfare. In its recent report on Florida, it estimates about 200 children with DCF contact died last year. Neil Skeen is the former special counsel for DCF, and state lawmakers are using his research to craft reforms. He says Kathy's story is frustratingly typical.
I mean, you've got, in the case you described with Kathy, a person who's motivated to improve the lives of herself and her family, and just somehow can't get the level of support that is needed from the state system.
Skeen says even children who survive in dangerous homes can endure abuse and neglect or go missing. DCF has a legal obligation to try to keep families together. It's supposed to teach parents proper discipline and home safety and remove children from danger. The Casey Family Report shows a failure to meet that goal, and DCF is not denying it.
Oh, I think it's definitely accurate.
That's DCF Programs head Stephen Pennypacker.
I was actually part of the group that went through the reports before we gave them to Casey to make sure that we had a sufficient sample.
Pennypacker says DCF wants to protect children. He says it's voluntarily studying gaps in services, upgrading technology, and improving response times and safety. Here's the catch. How can a worker go into a home and say, wow, until this situation is better, this child needs to not be here for a while? How empowered are people to make those decisions quickly and effectively?
They've always been empowered to do that.
So DCF could have helped Kathy. It could have removed children from known abusers before caregivers killed them. It could have protected infants who suffocated instead of asking addict parents to sign notes promising to provide safe beds. These are real stories from the Casey Report. Neil Skeen again.
It's just hard to imagine some of the decisions that get made by people in the face of the reality that these young people are facing in their homes or in their living conditions, whatever they are.
Skeen says the reform decision for DCF is the governor's appointment of the next secretary. The person could create a culture of common sense that gives workers knowledge and confidence. Senate President Don Gates is driving DCF reform bills in the Florida legislature. He praises Skeen's research, but disagrees with giving workers freedom.
Accountability is the first step toward remedying a problem, finding out what went wrong, diagnosing the weaknesses in the system, and then fixing them.
Senate bills heading for floor vote seek to improve certification and oversight of DCF workers, intensify investigations of child deaths, and help medically complex children. They have support in the House. Governor Rick Scott wants $31 million to hire more DCF investigators. That's a turnaround from 2011, when he proposed a $179 million cut. Kathy and Ordaz say they just want kids who need help to get it. I'm Amy Kiley in Orlando.
Still to come on Capitol Report, children of undocumented workers rally for in-state tuition at the Florida Capitol.
They told me that they really couldn't do anything about it, that it wasn't, because it's not a permanent residency, it's a temporary residency that you can reapply for, that it had to be put as an out-of-state.
State employees could see more health insurance options under a proposal to revamp the state's health insurance system, and for the most part, lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle are okay with the changes.
Employees do not have to take it. They have a choice. They can continue doing what they're doing now if they don't see the value in it.
And a Senate panel passes an import ban on invasive lionfish, and that's just one of the proposals aimed at getting rid of them.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment.
As a bill granting in-state tuition to some children of immigrants passed out of the Florida House, students from a number of state universities rallied for its passage by the full legislature. As Stan Jastrzebski reports in the first of a two-part story, those most affected by the potential change tried to make their voices heard in Tallahassee today.
The action on the Florida House floor was but an afterthought, really, expected to be conducted at a reasonable volume. But the volume was decidedly turned up on the steps of the historic Capitol hours earlier.
When do we want it?
Tuition equity!
When do we want it?
Now!
Students from Florida State, the University of Florida, and other schools organized by the group Students for a Democratic Society gathered to support what they call tuition equity, the principle that students who are either undocumented immigrants or who fall under a federal program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals should be afforded the same tuition rates and benefits as U.S. citizen Floridians. It'd be a lucky break for Mariana Castro, who moved with her family to Florida from Peru, thanks to another bit of good fortune.
Some people in my family had won a visa in Peru. There's like a lottery visa that you get.
But when the honors student from the Orlando area, who performed well enough at Celebration High School to earn a Bright Futures scholarship, enrolled at the University of Florida and looked at her financial statements, she discovered her luck had run out.
I came to UF, for orientation, and then I saw that the Bright Futures wasn't there anymore. And I asked them, I'm like, why did the $2,500 just disappear? And they're like, well, because it says here that you are sent out of state, the computer automatically takes it away.
What's more, Castro is now paying out-of-state tuition, which is 3 to 4 times more expensive than the in-state rate. That's a problem the bill would help correct for some students like Castro.
When I say student, you say power. Student!
Power!
But no matter how many chants and angry glances the students directed at the lawmakers in the building across the Capitol courtyard from them, the reality is it's up to lawmakers to make the change. And in the Senate, the bill squeaked by its first committee by the narrowest of margins. That worries Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto, who stood with the students Thursday.
The movement in the House is encouraging. In the Senate, though, there was a 5-4 vote. That is not things running smoothly.
He says the bill isn't seen as an education measure. It's viewed by lawmakers from conservative districts as an immigration bill, and they feel they can't support it because if they do, their district will elect someone else.
Their concern is primarily political, primaries and things like that. I don't think this issue has wholly been about the actual merits of it.
So as the bill moves to the Florida Senate, the issue of merit is important. Not necessarily the merits of the bill, but whose opinions merit more consideration, students or voters. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
On tomorrow's Capitol Report, Jessica Palumbo has more on the bill, which its supporters say has already undergone a transformation that's watered it down considerably. Florida lawmakers tinkering with the state employee health insurance program are poised to revamp the entire system. As Lynn Hatter reports, if the proposal is okayed by the legislature, it's uncertain whether state workers would see their insurance costs go up or down.
Sanford Republican Representative Jason Brodeur says the state health insurance program is outdated and it doesn't give employees what they want. Brodeur says workers who have chosen the state's HMO plan get more benefits, yet they pay the same rate as those on the state's PPO plans, which have fewer. He claims that's a situation unique to Florida, and it forms the basis for his plan to revamp the program.
If you talk with anybody in the industry, including Representative Murphy, who I spoke with yesterday, who I hope will speak to this, she will tell you just how far, I think out of whack is probably the technical term, that we are in both our offerings and our take-up rates, which tells us a couple things. It tells us that we're not offering what people want, and we're not offering the kind of value that we could have to our state workers.
That's Newport Richey Democratic Representative Amanda Murphy he's talking about. She's a financial advisor with the firm Raymond James, and she points out the cost to state employees is far lower than what coverage would cost in the private sector.
For instance, a $30,000 a year salary out in some corporations, the cost of the health care is $300 for a family or more versus the $180 that it is here. So that's what I'm talking about. These are tax dollars. These belong to the taxpayers of Florida.
Bordura says there should be a difference in cost for employees that go with less expensive coverage. He also argues the change is necessary to account for the growth and how much the state is spending on state employee health benefits. In the past decade, the cost to the state has doubled to more than $15,000 a year for family coverage, while the employee contribution has remained the same at a little over $2,100 a year. The bill would also direct the state to establish tiers of coverage by 2017, similar to those in the Federal Affordable Care Act, with bronze, silver, gold, and platinum levels. The state would contribute a fixed amount of money toward the purchase of a plan, and the employee would pitch in the rest. Employees could pay more for higher value plans or pocket the savings if they choose smaller ones. The proposal also creates a pilot program in up to three counties to establish market pricing for some common procedures. The costs would be posted on the state health insurance website. The goal is to make state employees shop around. If an employee chooses a less expensive place to have a procedure done, that's more money in their pocket. If the procedure is performed in a place that charges more than the market rate, the patient would have to pay the difference. But House Health and Human Services Committee Chairman Richard Corcoran stresses the pilot is voluntary.
It's very carefully crafted. Representative Broder's done a great job. It's three regions. It's the length of time. And the providers that are in that pilot are the contracted providers that we already have in our existing plans. It's not like we're sending employees or incentivizing them to go down to Dr. Jones down by the river in the cabin, knock three times, get a heart surgery for $5,000 and pocket the rest. That's not happening.
But it does concern Ponte Vedra Beach Republican Representative Doc Renuart. He says as a doctor, he is liable for where he refers a patient, and he believes the less expensive option is not necessarily the best one.
And I don't make a referral based just on the least expensive. I do it based on quality because I know that I'm held to that standard too. There needs to maybe be some kind of a protection if the patient selects the less expensive option on their own, you know, that those who have maybe advised them otherwise will not be held to the responsibility the patient should have.
Jacksonville Democratic Representative Mia Jones cast the lone no vote on the bill. Jones noted the state has made several changes to the state health insurance program in recent years, and she thinks lawmakers should wait to see how those changes play out before doing more. The state expects to spend nearly $2 billion on health insurance for more than 173,000 policyholders in the current fiscal year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a preview of some major legislative items on tomorrow's Capital calendar.
The House Economic Affairs Committee is scheduled to meet at 9, and topping the agenda is gaming legislation involving the creation of a Department of Gaming Control, authorizing and directing the governor to negotiate and execute an amendment to the gaming compact with the Seminole Tribe of Florida, also transferring the Division of Paramutual Wagering of the Department of Business and Professional Regulation to the Gaming Control Board within the Department of Gaming. The House Judiciary Committee meets at 9, will take up an exploitation of the elderly bill. It expands the prohibition on fraudulent use of personal identification information to include persons 60 years of age or older. There's also a bill that deals with sexual offenses against students by authority figures. It provides for a severity ranking of various offenses. There's a nursing home litigation bill that specifies who can be sued for mistreatment of residents. The House State Affairs Committee will take up a bill that would require all divers to display divers down flags or buoys in areas where diving occurs. At 9:30, there's the Florida Department of Transportation Bicycle Ride of the Capitol, this to promote Florida Bicycle Safety Awareness Month. At noon, Tallahassee Citizens Against the Death Penalty will gather at the Capitol for a service of remembrance. Those are some of the meetings and activities in the Florida Legislature for Friday, March 21st. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
In the ongoing battle against a non-native fish invading state waters, a Senate committee passed a bill today that prohibits lionfish from being imported or raised in Florida. As Jessica Palumbo reports, fish sellers say they support the general idea of the ban, but still have some reservations.
Tanks full of colorful fish line the walls of Carol's Critters Pet Shop in Tallahassee, where Jerry Peterson holds this title.
Fish manager. I order fish every week and supplies and that sort of thing.
He stops next to a 75-gallon tank. This, he says, is where the lionfish would be if they were in stock.
But usually the ones that we get are only like 2 to 3 inches, so they're babies. But yeah, generally we try to keep them in as large of a tank as possible, kind of separated from small fish, obviously.
That's probably because the pet shop doesn't want to lose a lot of small fish.
They'll eat any and everything. We found lionfish with over 30 fish in their stomach.
Claire Thomas has studied invasive lionfish at the Cape Eleuthera Institute in the Bahamas. She says Florida is not alone in dealing with the beautiful yet voracious predators. Biologists say they first showed up off the coast of South Florida in the mid-80s after being imported from the Far East and then most likely released from an aquarium.
And now they stretch all the way south to Venezuela, north up the coast of the United States to New York City.
Thomas says the spiny, poisonous fish can survive in most habitats. They reproduce quickly and don't have many natural predators, allowing them to ravage Florida's fragile coral reef ecosystems.
I mean, we over here would completely support the idea of not allowing any further import, although it's already a problem there.
On Thursday, the Senate Environmental Preservation and Conservation Committee unanimously approved the import ban sponsored by Baker Republican Greg Evers. It would also prohibit raising the fish in captivity and selling imported lionfish. Scott Hughes, who owns Fort Pierce-based saltwaterfish.com, says he has mixed feelings about the proposal.
That restriction would put me at a disadvantage versus others that are not based in Florida.
But he says he actually supports the ban on importing the two lionfish species already present in Florida, as long as he can continue selling lionfish caught in the Atlantic Ocean, for which he charges $25 a pop.
We've been buying Florida Atlantic lionfish for, gosh, 3 or 4 years. We've probably been in the forefront of this and trying to create a market to get them out of the waters.
Getting them out of Florida's waters has also been on the minds of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Spokeswoman Amanda Nally says proposals currently before the commission include creating lionfish tournaments, loosening fishing restrictions for them, and yes, a ban on importing and raising them.
Really, anything that we can do to help control that lionfish population is something that we're probably going to try.
So even if the legislature doesn't pass it, a lionfish ban still could go into effect later this year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando, with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at FRLA.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.